You are listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system. On RadioAryan.com.
I think they're getting out of hand. Well, you know what happened to those who complain. We've got to stop them seeing light. Let them think it's all right, 'cause the fireworks aren't to keep them entertained. Well, the wells have not run dry. Do we really need to lie? We'll say it's a national emergency. We'll send a wedding full of clowns, and we'll kick them while they're down. Get the banks control, 'cause they are friends to me. Let's go and find a better place. We'll call it New America. Won't it be a lovely place to be? Imperial material, the mind of New America, the best idea since democracy.
Hello and welcome once again to the Roper Report, Billy's Balkanization Podcast, right here on RadioAryan.com. As you know, each week, Wednesday at 3 p.m. Central, we bring you news and political commentary, and here on the Roper Report, we never punch right, because there's nothing to our right, except for the wall. We also never repeat slander about the alt-light, so we hope that you're very careful and listen close the first time. This week on the Roper Report, we've got a lot to talk about, from psychology to anthropology, from new developments in the Charlottesville drama, to the Stormfront Conference coming up this fall as we move forward into the future. So let's get started. First, a lot of our listeners have been asking me to comment further about my ideas on gender and sex behavior psychology. And I've been reading, once again, Desmond Morris's The Naked Ape. Now, last week, I talked about this, at least in the beginning, and I told you that I would flesh out my commentary a little bit more. I've been ruminating this week about it, and really, I would like to make it clear that the MGTOW guys, the white Sharia guys, are so far off base that we really can't blame them. They're so lost and so pathetically, almost apathetically unaware of their own lack of direction that they are the victims here as well as the women they despise. And I'm not talking about yellow fever race traitors like Andrew Anglin, or yellow fever guys like Jared Taylor who think that Asians are superior to whites and that Jews are whites. I'm talking more about those who literally resent white women and allow them, actually, resent white women because they have a hard time getting a date. And for a lot of millennial guys, that's a major concern. If they want a woman with traditional values, that is, a woman who's not slept around with a lot of non-whites, that's really, really a challenge. And as Generation Z turns 18, that's going to be less of a challenge because actually the younger generation are more red-pilled, more woke than millennials. They've been less brainwashed. So there is some hope for you guys who are millennials. But let me first address the mote in our own eye, guys. You know, women admittedly vote and think with their hearts. And I guess that the lady listeners might very well respond to me by saying that, yeah, guys don't vote or think with their hearts. They vote with an organ a little bit further south. And you could say that some guys actually think with their stomachs, just below the heart. I've often told my wife that if they really wanted to make successful perfume, they wouldn't make perfume that smelled like flowers or gardenias or musk. They would actually make perfume that smelled like ribs or fried chicken because that's what would really attract guys. I've never seen a guy, you know, walking down the street and seeing a pretty girl say, oh, she smelled like lavender. No. If you walked down the street and saw a girl who smelled like a steak, that'd probably be a lot more attractive to him. Because what perfume does is sublimates the natural attraction that feminine scent has to the male olfactory senses and olfactory glands that we still have hardwired in us. When a lady smells good, you know, when I smell my wife's hair, it smells nice to me. When a lady smells good, that's a very strong signal that guys cue in on. And it's because we still have that olfactory drive that's part of the reproductive drive. But what they do today is women wash off their natural odor, which attracts men, and then replace it with some kind of watered-down floral scent, which does not.
Working for love in all the wrong places. Working for love.
Really, like I said, if you want to appeal to a more base, primitive male instinct, you should just, you know, slather on some barbecue sauce, and that would probably attract a lot more guys. Reality is, women do not dress to attract men. They dress to impress other women or to outdo other women. But it's really weird the way that monogamy has affected human sexual behavior. For example, you know, women wear bras to accentuate their bust line, and then they cover those bras up in very demure, modest clothing to not put out too blaring of an advertisement, so it's not like, you know, sirens and klaxons going off and neon lights flashing. And it's not exactly Sharia where women are covered from nose to ankle, but it's definitely almost a hint, a more demure insinuation than it is something just outlandishly, provocatively obvious. And that's, I think, what's attractive to guys is, you know, more a hint of romance and a promise that there's something more to be discovered than something that is just in your face. And that's a subtlety of attraction. Now, obviously, we have to accept the fact that women do a lot of this subconsciously, just like a lot of the things that we guys do, we do subconsciously without thinking about it. No guy really outthink plots and schemes about how to attract women too much. That is, if they're really heterosexual. The fact is, guys probably think a lot less about how to attract girls than girls think about how to attract guys. And that's kind of counterintuitive because, you know, the reality is it's an old saying that no woman ever leaves the bar alone unless she really wants to. Guys do have to compete for women, regardless of whether they're alphas or betas, and women really have their pick of the litter. That's just the way that nature works. And it goes back to that reproductive process and the way that women have to invest, you know, at least 9 months, but in reality, a couple of years into each process of producing another little human being, and guys, you know, have to invest 5 minutes. And that's why women naturally want to have one man as a mate and as a defender and protector to provide them with everything they need. And basically, men need every woman to give them the one thing that they need because they don't have to invest a lot of time. Their reproductive advantage is in spreading their seed as widely as possible. But monogamy creates a limited, controversial compromise of those two competing reproductive strategies. And the way that that has developed as monogamy became the rule rather than the exception, especially in Western Christian societies, is that we compromise, we make trades, and as a couple, when man and woman come together, they each provide most of what the other needs for happiness and mutual satisfaction, right? And so both are relatively happy. It's kind of like a compromise in a business deal. No one gets everything exactly the way they want it, but no one is left completely alone, and everyone gets enough to be able to shake hands or the conjugal equivalent and consider the deal done. So women, not thinking with their brains but with their hearts, are naturally more sympathetic and empathetic to the downtrodden and to minorities And like I've said before, you know, that's necessary in a racially homogeneous society. It's a great thing because it's what keeps crying babies from being thrown out of the cave at 3 a.m. and we'd be extinct without it. And I personally really love the soft sympathy of my wife. And I could not live without the soft sympathy of a woman, the compassion, the nurturing. And whether it is from our mothers when we were a kid or from our wives when we were grown men, guys need that. And that is how we actually define femininity. We don't really like women who are loud and brash and macho because they're not feminine. They are manly, just like women, regardless of what they really say. Now, in the truth, women like guys who are masculine, who speak up and say what they think and basically do what they want. That's why women like bad boys, because women are attracted to alpha males. They're not attracted to betas or to losers or the, you know, sensitive type guys. They're always going to be, you know, taking the leftovers, because in reality, women are attracted to outlaws. They're attracted to alpha males. And we can't and should not want to socially engineer that away, because that means that the most aggressive males, the most dominant males, the alpha males, have a greater opportunity then to reproduce and to pass their superior, dominant, aggressive genes on to the next generation than the bunch of betas do, who really should be bred out. If it's something that's genetic especially, not just some kind of environmental problem. But we get to this nexus of genes and environment. And actually, there's a lot of current genetic theory which seems to indicate that a lot of our environment becomes our genetics. And it's not just based on our diet. You know, the whole controversy this last week over saying that the first Briton was a black guy, regardless of the holes that Savannah and I punched in that theory in last week's The Daily Nationalist program, came from the fact that the Jewish researcher was being paid to try to support the theory that the pharmaceutical company was being put forward that diet changes your genes. And despite his political spin on things, which was wrong, as well as being incorrect, it's true that your environment and your diet does change your genes. I'm not talking about just in terms of macroevolution or adapting to your environment and your climate and, you know, developing different skin and hair and eye color in order to survive in that environment, or things like developing the ability to digest lactose so that you can supplement your diet by herding cattle and drinking their milk and eating their cheese. But what he said was that prior to that development, vitamin D actually had to be received from the sun rather than from milk and cheese. And so that was why he said that the melanin content in the human remains that were found in the Cheddar Valley indicated that the person was darker complected than modern Britons and modern Europeans are. Well, he's wrong and incorrect, both, which are two separate things. But it is true that beta males often are made beta by absorption of things like soy and even drinking water that has been polluted by women flushing their birth control pills for three generations and adding estrogen to the groundwater supply. So the added estrogen from soy and from drinking groundwater that's been polluted by birth control pills and smoking marijuana, which increases the amount of estrogen in a man's body, makes him literally more feminine. All these things make alpha males into beta males. But it's also true that the feminist movement, literally making women more masculine, making women have to work and to compete aggressively in business and in finance against men for jobs, makes women more masculine and increases their testosterone while it decreases their estrogen, because women become more aggressive in order to compete with men in a business environment in the workplace. And women actually, through feminism, believe that guys like them to all be marathon runners. And so they take aerobics and they start jogging and they literally eliminate almost all of their body fat, which increases their muscle mass, which makes them more masculine, which also increases their testosterone, So our diet and our behavior in terms of exercise, our lack of exercise, makes men more or less masculine with more or less testosterone, and women with more or less estrogen, more masculine or less masculine, depending on their behavior and their diet as well. Now, what this all leads to when it comes together is that there is a reason why you see these pussy hat wearing feminists screaming in the streets. They're not acting very feminine, these feminists, are they? They're acting pretty darn masculine. Their cords of their throat are tight, and they're shrieking, and they're shrill, and they're angry. They're shaking and frothing at the mouth and spitting and rage like a berserker. And that's because they are not at all very feminine anymore. They are the least feminine of the females of our species that are left. And they are resentful of the fact they're alone. They're resentful of the fact that they're going to be old cat ladies. They're resentful of the fact that they are the least attractive of their half of the species, and that very few guys really want them. And they're resentful of the fact that the only guys who associate with them, who share their politics, and who can tolerate their worldview as they express it, are beta males. Because, let's face it, there are not a lot of alpha males on the left. In general, most of the alpha males tend to be on the right, tend to be right-wing, and guys on the left, the guys who would be attracted to these feminists because of their political worldview, or could even tolerate being around them for long enough to get within scent of them, are going to be leftist beta males. So, of course, the feminists resent that too. So if they're not already lesbians, they might find that the women that are around them are more masculine than the men that are around them on the left. Now, whenever we talk about male-female relations, we have to consider all these factors: that diet and exercise and climate and environment and the way they've been taught in schools to behave really affects male-female relations. Men were taught up until the last generation to let boys be boys, and girls were taught to play with dolls. But now everyone wants to allow their kids to choose their gender and to dress them as the opposite gender and to make boys play with dolls and girls play, well, not with guns because that's politically incorrect, make girls play with fire trucks. And to tell little girls they can grow up to be anything they want to be. And if they want to be a policeman or be a soldier, then they can. And little boys, if they want to be ballerinas, then that's great. And you should never try to define your kid's gender. Well, you don't have to define your kid's gender. You know, kids naturally, at some point, are going to look down the front of their diaper and figure it out. And that's how you define gender. But for the last generation, we've been redefining gender for these kids and making it something very ambiguous and amorphous. And so imagine now, if you're a 20-year-old, and you've been raised questioning your own gender, questioning your own sexual orientation, questioning your own biological identity, and then you're being told that there are no real gender roles, there are no real authentic biological differences between the sexes, and certainly no authentic legitimate differences between the sex roles of men and women. And then you're thrown out into the dating world, where no one knows what they're oriented with, whether they like males or females, or sometimes both, or often neither, or if they're pansexual or potsexual. And then imagine trying to find someone from the other gender who knows they're of the other gender and has some semblance of traditional values. Yes, I get it, guys. Yes, I get it, ladies. I understand why you're frustrated. I understand why you're resentful. But guys, I'm going to speak mainly to you because most of my listeners are guys. You cannot blame the ladies in your peer group, your age group, for this. This has been done to them, and it's been done to them because we guys let it be done. Like I've talked about before, if we want women to behave as naturally, psychologically healthy women should, if we want them to be feminine, then we have to, as guys, behave as naturally healthy psychologically, guys should. We have to behave in a masculine manner. Women are not going to respect and should not respect losers and defeatists and cucks and betas. They're not going to respect and should not respect guys who step off the sidewalk and act like they've been conquered by a bunch of niggers. they will go to the alpha males and those they see who are acting like they've conquered. And who today in America acts like the winners? Who today acts like they're the toughest? It's not us. So if we want to change the behavior of white women and make them to start responding to our behavior in a healthy way, because that's what women do, then we need to start acting like healthy, victorious, conquering white men always have once again. Now, that's not to take any of the blame away from feminism, which was engineered by Jews to divide our race and to make us enemies against each other. Women like Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem and Bella Abzug, feminism was started by Jewish women to try to divide white men and white women and to make us into enemies when we're not only natural allies, they are our only natural allies. They are our other halves that complete us and make us whole. Without them, we are literally nothing and we are extinct. And vice versa is true as well. So we should not spend time worried about how feminism has hurt our race, or how women's voting patterns have hurt our race, or how women's reproductive choices through abortion and birth control have hurt our race, or how women seeking careers rather than having a bunch of children has hurt our race. It's like a relationship of two people. You can look at the macrocosm of the relationship between men and women in the white race today as being an enlarged picture of a relationship as if it were one man and one woman. Now, we are told in order to be successful in a relationship that we should not keep score. We should not hold on to petty past grievances or wounds, even if we have been legitimately hurt. We're told that we should forgive and forget and try to move forward in love, because to not do so is self-destructive. And if we truly believe in what we're fighting for, the 14 words, that we must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children, then David Lane, who penned them, also penned the second half, the second 14 words of that homily, which says, "So that the beauty of the white Aryan woman shall not perish from the earth." That's why we fight. Because I could not live with, like Andrew Anglin, an Asian woman, or like Chris Cantwell, a Puerto Rican woman, or like Richard Spencer, a black woman. I could only live with a white woman. That means that I have to fight for them. And of course, also I'm a Christian identist, so I believe that this is the righteous cause to fight against God's enemies and against our enemies, and that we will win. But even if you don't have that, you should recognize that we need to reconcile ourselves to move forward and not dwell on who did what to whom in the male versus female dichotomy of our race. It's time to realize we need to think about the future and do what we need to do. And I'm speaking to you guys as men to win our women back, to give them the opportunity to trust us once again, to depend on us once again, to have faith in us once again, that we will be their defenders and their protectors, and we will rebuild a civilization which will honor them and cherish them and hold them to their natural feminine behavior, because they look to us for leadership and direction and guidance. And it's our natural role to provide it. And if we return to that natural role ourselves as being their defenders and protectors, then they will return to their natural roles as being our helpmates and our supporters, our inspiration and our encouragement. So I'll continue to talk over the next few weeks about male-female relationships, because it really hurts me to see young men and women, half my age, having trouble finding someone of traditional values of the opposite gender to make a family with, which is what they really should be trying to do. It really does hurt me to see these guys who are so bitter and resentful against white women that they think that white women are our enemy. And it also hurts me to see these white girls who are feeling like they need to behave as if their thoughts are sluts to get white guys' attention. I think that that's what guys really want. And if guys really want that, then the guys are wrong. And women should not go down that route, because the guys who are really worth getting, they don't need all that. So I'll continue to talk about this circumstance that now faces us as a race, where it seems like there are some on both sides who would like to divide men and women into opposing camps and make them into enemies, when really we are the only allies that each other has. Now, also, I want to mention that coming up February the 17th, we have the next Shield Wall Network meeting. The Shield Wall Network, which is open to women and to children and to the elderly, to families as well, was begun as a white nationalist preppers co-op where we could identify local resources, but also provide physical public activism, political expressions to defend our people, and also to move towards the future when we have balkanization happen and the stuff hits the fan, and we need to be able to defend not just our women, but our children and our elderly and one another as well through the new Shield Wall Phalanx, which is undergoing training. Now that weekend, next weekend, February the 17th, members of the Shield Wall Network Phalanx will be participating in Matthew Heimbach's speech with the TWP at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville that afternoon. And Shield Wall Phalanx members will be participating in the Knights Party and the League of the South flag rally in Harrison, Arkansas. So I'm pleased to announce that we have grown large enough as a network that now the Shield Wall can multitask. We can be in multiple places at once, just like many of us have always wished we could do. And so we'll be able to participate in all three of these events on the same day, at the same time, without having any of those three events be too small to be successful. As a matter of fact, the Shield Wall Network meeting happening in North Central Arkansas coming up next Saturday, based on the RSVPs I've received already from an invited guest, is going to be the largest meeting that we've had so far, with between 15 and 20 new affiliates attending for the very first time from throughout Arkansas, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Tennessee. So, next Saturday, the 17th of February, if you have not heard, you can email me at roper_billy@yahoo.com for details about the rendezvous point and how you can get an invitation to attend if you're going to be in the North Central Arkansas area or within driving range. Now, also coming up is next week's grand jury in Charlottesville. And I need to take a few minutes to really talk into some detail about this. Many of you have heard that beginning back in December, the FBI began issuing federal subpoenas to leftists, to Antifa, who were in Charlottesville for the Unite the Right rally on August the 12th. And they began protesting there at the federal courthouse in Charlottesville, saying that the left, who were issued those subpoenas, should not cooperate. Now, I want to tread carefully in what I say next, because by saying that, by advising their people directly not to answer, not to comply with the federal subpoenas, they actually open themselves up to federal charges of obstruction of justice and federal felony charges of witness tampering. So we want to make sure that we, on our side, avoid that pitfall. But I also want to be very forthright in talking about what people should and should not do, and about the rights that we have and the privileges that we still have that we should rely on. Now, as these FBI subpoenas are being issued, I talked to one guy who had a driver's license that saw an address from a previous state residence listed, and they went to his mother's residence where he formerly had lived and tried to serve the subpoena there, and now they're about to serve him in his new residence. He's spoken to them already, and apparently five or six other members of different organizations and independent white nationalists and alt-right members have already been served federal subpoenas by the FBI to appear at this federal grand jury that will begin next Tuesday and Wednesday, in Charlottesville, Virginia. So when you actually hear this broadcast, the federal grand jury will have convened. And as I advised some of these guys, they need to be aware of a couple of facts. Number one, a federal grand jury, once it is convened, can hold witnesses legally for up to 30 days. It's not just necessarily the case that they'll be able to be flown out there at taxpayer expense and put up in a motel at taxpayer expense and given some food vouchers and think of it like a two-day vacation and then be able to come back home. Secondly, they are going to be compelled, once they're there, to testify on behalf of the federal government. And the purpose of this federal grand jury is to seek federal civil rights violations against James Alex Fields, who drove the vehicle that was involved in the car accident in Charlottesville August 12th. So they are going after James Alex Fields for federal civil rights violations, and they are subpoenaing people from both the right and the left who were in Charlottesville or near the incident or who are thought to have been somehow near the incident to question them about that car accident as well as anything else they can dig up. So I don't want anyone to be confused about the nature of the questioning that they will undergo. They will literally be interrogated by the FBI and the Department of Justice. And I think that over the last few weeks with the FISA memo and the indication that there were several months worth of texts that were deleted between secret society FBI agents, between Stroke and his mistress, and the number three person in the DOJ just resigning, everyone above Rosenstein now being gone, Rosenstein being the guy who hired Mueller in the Department of Justice, and then Comey being fired for his malfeasance, and his deputy director, McCabe, being forced to resign, and McCabe and Comey's chief of staffs being forced to resign, and all that's come out about the collusion between the Department of Justice and the Federal Bureau of Investigation with the Obama campaign to act above the law, to be politicized, really is an indication of how much we can and should trust federal law enforcement in the Department of Justice and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. It's not just radicals who are no longer able to trust the federal government. The majority of white Americans are now seeing that the government cannot be trusted. And only those shrinking percentages in the center, the establishment elite, pragmatic collaborationist, whose foundation is being eroded from both the right and the left as people lose faith in the establishment and the government, only those shrinking percentages of centrist really still think that the electoral process and federal law enforcement is legitimate. But that makes the deep state, that makes federal law enforcement more and more radical, more and more desperate. And we see that desperation every single day. Now, my advice to people who are served with a federal subpoena or with a warrant is simply this. Remember that you still have rights. And one of those rights that you have is enshrined in our Constitution in the Fifth Amendment. It is the right not to say or do anything to incriminate yourself. You literally do not have to answer questions that might incriminate yourself. And if you don't believe that you'll be asked questions by the FBI which could tend to incriminate yourself, then you really don't understand a damn thing about how they operate when they play good cop and bad cop. And, you know, they even put some of the stuff out there in the controlled media, like in Law and Order, to make themselves seem omnipotent. But if you watch very closely, you'll see behind the snarkiness what they will do to get a confession, to get you to slip up and even misstate something, to contradict yourself even in the slightest, which will then allow them the opportunity in the room to attack you and to accuse you of committing perjury so that they can get some kind of confession out of you, even a false one. They have been doing this for decades, and they are consummate interrogators. They can break you down without ever touching you. And they do it over and over again every single day. A lot of people who have not been involved in the movement for very many years and have not seen it happen to so many people think that they can just have a conversation, some kind of witty dialogue, some kind of chat with the FBI, And because they're so smart and so clever that they're going to, recruit the FBI agent, turn them into an alt-right or white nationalist. In reality, they're going to try to jam up as many of our people as possible because that's their jobs. Now, these FBI agents who are issuing these federal subpoenas for the grand jury next week do not want you to know that the most important five words that you can remember is, I have nothing to say. You know, people like Tom Metzger spent years teaching those that the alt-right contemptuously refer to as WN 1.0 those five words that they could say, I have nothing to say. You cannot be waterboarded and forced to say something. Now, here's an example. You don't have to incriminate yourself. You can rely on your Fifth Amendment right. There may be a price for it. Just be prepared for that. Back before most of the alt-right millennials were born, there was a case here in Arkansas called Whitewater, and it involved the Clintons, believe it or not. Hillary and Bill Clinton were involved in a corrupt land deal, and some of their allies actually faced federal investigations. There was a special federal prosecutor named Kenneth Starr who was looking into allegations of misfeasance and malfeasance and corruption. And one of the Clintons' friends, named Susan McDougal, was under investigation in this Whitewater affair. And she was asked over and over again, week after week, month after month, to provide testimony. And repeatedly, Susan McDougal refused to testify or to give any evidence against the Clintons or anyone else. She repeatedly said that she wanted to rely on her Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. And anyone can do that, but the price that she paid for doing that was that she was charged with contempt of court and ended up spending about a year in jail because she continually refused to answer their questions and continued to rely on her Fifth Amendment right. And they continued to keep her in jail under contempt of court charges, but eventually the special prosecutor let it go, had her released. Now, she never had to give that information up. She was able to rely on her Fifth Amendment, but she did face charges of contempt of court. Some of our guys at some point are going to have to rely on their Fifth Amendment and not just say, oh, well, the federal government asked me to testify. I guess I have to. I can't say I won't answer the question. They'll throw me in jail. We have people who still today think that, you know, Dan Gaiman and Fraser Glenn Miller were justified in testifying against the order and the other guys of the Fort Smith Sedition trials because they would have gone to prison if they had not. Well, I'm sorry. They want us all to be extinct, remember? They want our grandkids to be faggots and mulattoes, and I guess some of us are probably going to maybe go to jail along the way to extinction. And that sucks. You know, but some of our guys are already in jail in Charlottesville, and a lot of them have been given the opportunity to fold. None of them have. So, people who are going to be testifying need to consider the fact that, you know, history is watching. And you do have the right to rely on your Fifth Amendment right to avoid self-incrimination. And you do have the right to just simply say, I have nothing to say. And if you must, face a contempt of court charge and spend a month or two or three in jail for it. And that's how you can avoid having your conscience nag you for the rest of your life and have everyone look at you as if maybe you're a snitch. So remember Susan McDougal, very brave lady. She also avoided, like so many people who testified against the Clintons have, committing suicide by shooting herself in the back of the head 17 times, you know, by relying on her Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination. Another thing to remember, if we really want to say that the federal government is Zog, Zionist-occupied government, or Jog, Jewish-occupied government, however you phrase it, if we really want to say that the federal government, and especially federal law enforcement, is the deep state, that it's been compromised and corrupted to the extent that it's no longer speaking for us, that it's no longer a government of, by, and for the people, not our people at least. If we really believe that the federal government is not legitimate, then one of the best ways to delegitimize it is not to play their game. One of the best ways to delegitimize the government, which so many of us say is already not legitimate, is to simply indulge in non-participation, to not go along with their script, to say, I have nothing to say, or to refuse to testify because you feel that anything you say may tend to incriminate you. Rely on your Fifth Amendment. Remember what your Miranda rights say when they arrest you, when they advise you of what your rights are. They're very blunt and frontwards with it. They say, anything you say or do can and will be used against you in a court of law. Let me repeat that. Anything that you say or do can or will be used against you in a court of law. This goes right along with people that put too much information out there on social media. You know, they put their home addresses, they put the pictures of everyone in their family, and if you're afraid of being doxxed, then don't go to a big protest and then plaster pictures of you in that protest and videos of you fighting in that protest all over social media and show it to everybody. You know, if you don't want to be doxxed, then either don't have social media, and believe me, if you think your social media is locked down and private, it's not as private as you think it is, unless every single person that you are friends with on Facebook or follow on Twitter or connected to on Gab or VK, unless you know every single one of them in person. And even then, I have known FBI informants who have been associated with the white nationalist movement for years, nearly a decade, before anyone knew they were bad. And people knew them personally, had them over for dinner, spent time with their family, knew everything there was to know about them, or so they thought. And I could name names if I wanted to. Most of you are too young to remember those names, but it has happened. And it still happens. And it's happening right now. So if you don't want to be doxxed, if you don't want to be exposed, if you don't want to lose your job, if you don't want to end up like me on the front lines, nothing left to lose, then be careful about what you put out there in social media. Be careful about what you're public about. We have this weird cognitive dissonance going on in our heads in the white nationalist movement today, where some people are still LARPing, and some people are really ready for blood, and some people are a little both. You know, there's some people who think this is a game, they're posturing, and there's some people who are just ready for the lights to go out, and some are, you know, kind of equivocating back and forth between those two positions. Now, here is a paradox. You know, people have said to me that I need to be very careful whenever I bring someone into the Shieldwall Network to make sure that I vet them. And I know for sure that I don't associate with anyone or encourage any of my friends to associate with anyone who might be a federal informant. And I just need to find out everything I can about people before I bring them into their circle and vet them completely. At the same time, the same people often tell me that we need to protect our identities and make sure that no one can dox us. People really shouldn't use their real names. Now, how the hell am I supposed to vet somebody who refuses to use their real name? You see what I mean? So you can't have it both ways, right? Either we're going to be frontline activists out there, devil may care, with nothing to lose, or we're going to be some kind of secret guerrilla operation. You can't have it both ways. And this is another thing that Tom Metzger said. There has to be a separation between the open white nationalist movement that's above ground and those who want to be guerrillas below ground and have their identities kept secret. And maybe a less martial way of expressing that today would be that those who are going to be professionals and maintain important jobs of influence and who are going to be able to finance the rest of us should keep their identities secret. But everyone else who doesn't have one of those very important professions or jobs and who doesn't have a family depending on them should really be on the front lines with nothing to lose, because you can't have it both ways. We cannot vet someone completely and eliminate someone who might be a fed from the ranks at the same time as we allow everyone to maintain their anonymity and not use their real names. The only solution that I have found is to tell people that I am not going to be associated by anyone talking about or doing anything illegal. And so the best I can do for them, even though it's not perfect, even though people have gone to jail and will go to jail in the future for not necessarily doing anything illegal, but the best that I can do right now is to tell people not to talk about or do anything illegal, and that at least mitigates the chances that they'll be jammed up. So remember Susan McDougal. And as you watch this federal grand jury convene this coming week in Charlottesville, you're probably going to see increased national media spotlight on the city once again. And it may affect the cases of some of the defendants who are already arrested, already being held there in Charlottesville, as well as the guy in Florida who's being held in the county jail there and facing extradition to Florida here in a couple weeks, as well as maybe some others who have not yet been arrested but are waiting for that shoe to drop even over Charlottesville. It may affect their cases. It will definitely affect James Alex Fields' future. It may affect the futures of those who either do or do not testify. And I'm not explicitly giving legal advice. I'm not telling people not to comply with the federal subpoena, because that would open myself up to a potential federal felony charge of obstruction of justice or witness tampering. What I am reminding each of you, not just those who have been subpoenaed, but everyone who is listening to this program, remember that you always have the right to say, I have nothing to say. And you always have your Fifth Amendment protected right to not self-incriminate. Now, whenever you use your rights, there may be consequences, whether it's your First Amendment right, or your Second Amendment right, or your Fifth Amendment right. But like our founding fathers, those patriots who also accepted the responsibility and the consequences of their actions, freedom is not free. We cannot expect mercy and grace of the federal government to be our salvation. And if we really want to delegitimize the illegitimate government, then we cannot behave as if it is legitimate. We cannot participate in it. We have to come out from among it at some point. Before I forget, I do need to make an early announcement about this fall and the upcoming 2018 Stormfront Conference. As many of you know, I was one of the organizers and speakers at the 2017 Stormfront Conference in Crossville, Tennessee. And it was a very successful event. Despite some challenges along the way, we were able to pull it off and get a lot of media coverage, but most importantly, give dozens of white nationalists the opportunity for many of them for the first time to network and communicate face-to-face, eye-to-eye with other people, many of whom they'd only known through Stormfront, through their screen names. So as these people who had only known each other on Stormfront met for the first time, they developed more trust, kind of similar to the way that we work with the Shield Wall Network to create very real, in real life, coalitions of people who become friends and know and trust one another explicitly. And as we look forward to the 2018 Stormfront Conference, I'm very pleased to announce that the Shield Wall Network has been asked to help organize and plan the 2018 Stormfront Conference once again this year. And we've also been asked to help handle the security for the 2018 Stormfront Conference. So there'll be a lot of very well-known white nationalist and alt-right speakers who will be presenting at the 2018 Stormfront Conference, but there'll also be activism workshops and seminars, just as we set the precedent for in the 2017 Stormfront Conference. I've been discussing with Father Francis, the host of the Stormfront Action radio program, which you can hear every morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Central Time on Stormfront Radio at the Rents Radio Network, about how we can plan this coming conference. We'll be having meetings over the next few months, working into the summer, to make this a very successful conference. If you're interested in attending the 2018 Stormfront Conference, and you'd like to find out more, I encourage you to contact me or Father Francis at Stormfront. He is Copperhead on the Stormfront Forum, and I am Billy Roper on the Stormfront Forum, ironically enough. Or, as always, you can email me at roper_billy@yahoo.com or contact me through Gab, where I am at Billy Roper, or you can call me at 870-214-0465. Once again, that number is 870-214-0465. 214-0465. What we're planning is for the Shieldwall Network Phalanx, our defensive arm of the Shieldwall Network, to be carrying the brunt, if you will, of the defensive responsibilities in the security aspect of the 2018 Stormfront Conference, working in conjunction with our allies in the Nationalist Front, with the League of the South, and with TWP, as well as other white nationalist activists, to make sure that everyone who attends the 2018 Stormfront Conference will be safe and secure without any threats from Antifa or any other potential anti-white terrorist. So we want you to feel comfortable in bringing your families, your children, to this very important event coming up this fall, the 2018 Stormfront Conference. And once more, you can contact Copperhead, that's Father Francis, on the Stormfront bulletin board at stormfront.org, or me, Billy Roper, or you can email me at roper_billy@yahoo.com, or call me at 870-214-0465 to find out more about how you can get involved in the planning and organizing of the 2018 Stormfront Conference. And if you'd like to be a speaker at the event, then we'd be happy to discuss that with you as well. Once again, that's the 2018 Stormfront Conference coming up this fall, brought to you by Stormfront and the Shieldwall Network. So, remember the five words, I have nothing to say, and remember the Fifth Amendment, that you do not have to say or do anything to incriminate yourself. Speaking of government and how we can hurt our enemies, a recent report by the controlled media in Memphis, which featured video of my striptease before we went into the metal detector and the pat-down line to get into the rally point on the rally for Forrest we had in Memphis last month. The controlled media now admits that our actions requiring the 4C blocks to be shut down, the two parks to be closed, and dump trucks and overtime, all their expenses, cost the city of Memphis $152,000 that the city of Memphis had to spend for the Rally for Forrest, the Shieldwall Network, and our allies held January the 6th in Memphis, Tennessee. So they thought they would get away with buying those two parks for $1,000 each through that Memphis green space. Now they're being told they may have to return the monuments and put them back up. The state of Tennessee is probably going to force them to do that. It's interesting to watch. And we cost them $152,000, which is, you know, not a whole lot in the big scheme of things, but we didn't spend $10,000 to pay for an auditorium. We pulled together our funds for a tank of gas and cost Memphis $152,000 of their own money. So that was cool. Also here in Arkansas, we responded to Philip Martin's article in the Jewish-owned, run by Paul Greenberg, Arkansas Democrat Gazette, which said that miscegenation is the best hope for the world and mongrelization is the best thing that could happen to the United States. This kind of leads into our move here in Arkansas to make it Ozarkia through the Shieldwall Network's Project New America. Now, in other parts of the country, they're trying really hard to make it happen. They're trying really hard to cajole and to encourage and to talk people into moving there because they really want to kick off a revolution or a secession and to make it happen there. Here in Ozarkia, here in the Upper South, we're going to let it happen because it's already happening organically and naturally through internal migrations of whites from non-white and darkening areas. So whenever we look at articles like happened in the San Francisco Chronicle this morning, it's talked about the Bay Area has experienced a surge of people moving out of the whole Bay Area, many of them moving to Tennessee and the Upper South and to Arkansas. You know, that's a trend that we need to be wary of to make sure that those people fleeing blue states don't bring their liberal ideas with them and corrupt our areas, but at the same time, they're voting with their feet, and no one's having to ask them to. They're doing it organically. And that's why Ozarkia, our Project New America, the Shieldwall Network, is what we're doing here in Arkansas and in adjacent surrounding states. And if you'd like to hear more about that, once again, you can come to our meeting coming up next Saturday, February the 17th, in North Central Arkansas. And you can email me at roper_billy@yahoo.com to find out more. Now, I don't want to say too much about the Stolen Valor drama where Elliot Klein, Eli Mosley, the former leader of Identity Europa, has been pegged by the New York Times as falsely claiming to have a military record that he did not have And I don't want to indulge in supposition about how that will affect Identity Europa serving as staff and bodyguards for Richard Spencer, or how that might affect his future actions. I will say that Spencer, in the MPI article that I read, is obviously preparing to distance himself and disavow Mosley just as quickly as he did Kessler after the Heather Heyer tweet. But really, Identity Europa has become, meh, right? What are they really doing? The nice white polo shirts and khakis have pretty much been played out, and they've been optic cucks for so long that really all I can say is, for being optic cucks and not wanting people to have the Confederate flag or National Socialist regalia, then really, how does this make us look, guys, when you have stolen valor going on by your leader? How does that make us look as an optic cuck, you know? So, the Charlottesville defendants are looking to see what's going to happen next week with this federal grand jury, and even as they do, you know, Jacob Goodwin, has some good news he'd like for me to share, that his lawyer, Elmer Woodard, has gotten the medical records of DeAndre Harris, which indicate that the contact points between Jacob Goodwin and DeAndre Harris did not result in any wounds. So the state's charge of malicious wounding is completely unsupported by evidence. So you expect some really good news from the Jacob Goodwin aspect of the Charlottesville defense case soon based on that. But as we get to the end of the hour, I want to wrap up by reminding people that the most important thing that we can do for our movement and for our families and for ourselves is to not focus on the big tent in unity. You know, I guess people back in the 1930s probably thought they would have told Hitler, you know, I guess Skull Smasher 1488 would have tweeted at the Fuhrer, you know, that he was being a purity spiraler and that Ernst Röhm had done a lot to bring new people into the movement. And that, you know, Ernst Röhm was just indicating the last bastion of implicit whiteness. And that, you know, his differences between himself and the Strasser brothers weren't really that important. That he should wait until he had defeated communism and removed all the Jews from Europe and actually had victory before he should purity spiral against the SA or against the Strasser brothers or against the Free Corps. But frankly, they would have been wrong. And if they had told George Washington that he should have been a lot nicer to Benedict Arnold so they could get along better, and so that Benedict Arnold wouldn't be turning traitor because he was resentful of Washington being made the commander of the Continental Army, then, you know, they would have been wrong. And if they would have told, you know, Alexander Hamilton that he should lay off the whole monarchy thing, and if they had told the Founding Fathers they shouldn't shoot each other in duels, they would have been wrong. Because that's how natural selection works. And remember that Jesus said that I have not come to bring peace. I have come to bring a sword. I have not come to bring peace. I have come to start a fire. And what do I care if it's kindled already? So let us be like our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, and not be so cut about unity and the big tent and kumbaya, everybody holding hands and getting along, that we refuse to have standards, that we refuse to speak the truth. Because 5 years from now, none of these personalities will still be around, and probably most people won't remember their names. But the standards that we establish and we maintain are eternal and will carry us forward into our future. Until next time, this is Billy Roper for The Roper Report, Billy's Balkanization Podcast, and the Shield Wall Network, which you can find at ArianWarrior.com, along with The Roper Report's podcast at The Roper Report on Billy Roper's YouTube channel. That's YouTube.com/SLE/Billy Roper, and the Billy Roper Rope Report blog at whitenationalist.com, reminding you to think racially, act locally, but no matter what else, keep it white.
Can you hear the student band? I think they're getting out of hand. Well, you know what happened to those who complain. We've got to stop them seeing light. Let them think it's all right. Do the fire outside to keep them entertained. Well, the wells have not run dry. Do we really need to lie? We'll say it's a national emergency. We're at a wedding full of clowns. I won't kick them while they're down. Get the banks control, because they are friends to me.
listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.